Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Are the police protecting citizens, or are they at war with citizens? In most places in America, this is a ridiculous proposition. Of course the police are protecting us. The police are our friends. But in enough communities to make it a national crisis of law and justice, this is the central question of civic life. How is order preserved when unarmed civilians die? This is a question being asked in the 54-block neighborhood of downtown L.A. called Skid Row, where a homeless man died this week in a fatal encounter with police. It is a question in Ferguson, Missouri, in Staten Island, New York, and many other communities where local encounters with police have led to national investigations, national unrest, national soul-searching. On Monday, a Justice Department task force announced a series of recommendations to reform law enforcement nationwide. Among them, and I'll read you the list, embrace a guardian mindset to build public trust and legitimacy. Number two, acknowledge the role of policing in past and present injustice and discrimination and how it is a hurdle to the promotion of community trust. Number three, establish a culture of transparency and accountability in order to build public trust and legitimacy. Number four, law enforcement agencies should promote legitimacy internally within the organization by applying principles of procedural justice. And number five, proactively promote public trust by initiating what are called positive non-enforcement activities. Well, what do those recommendations, and there are more from the Justice Department, what do they mean? Sherrilyn Ifill is president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Sherrilyn, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, John.
What I want to do is sort of unpack these recommendations. They sound a little wonky and jargony, but I think within them are key principles that it's worth exploring here. What do you think is a guardian mindset to build public trust and legitimacy? Certainly the president talks about public trust in all of his discussions about law enforcement in the past 2 years.
Well, John, I think you identified it right at the top of the segment when you talked about are folks feeling as though they are at war with the police or the police feeling as though they are at war with communities. You know, you'll recall that in Darren Wilson's testimony before the grand jury in Ferguson, he described the community where he encountered Mike Brown as being a kind of anti-police community, at least in his mind. He already had a mindset that he was kind of entering a place where he would be under siege. And I think this recommendation from the task force is important because it is a reminder to the police that they are to regard themselves as guardians of the safety of all communities, rather than what we too often see entering communities as a kind of hostile, occupying force. That is how the police are experienced in so many African American communities, and that is how they behave in so many African American communities.
In looking at recommendation 2 and 3, acknowledge the role of policing in past and present injustices and establish a culture of transparency and accountability. Now, some might say this is the witch hunt. This is where you go after and indict people and put them in jail. How would you say, no, it's not simply prosecution, it's an acknowledgement piece that's just as important here?
Well, you know, one of the great problems, John, of dealing with racial discrimination is the insistence by so many that it doesn't exist. And frankly, it is the advent of the cell phone videos and the other proof that we've been able to see in the killing of Tamir Rice, in some of these police encounters over the last year that has actually captured the national imagination. It's not as though these incidents were not happening before, but we were not believed. And so this idea of truth and transparency is critically important. Think about all of the ways in which the conduct of the Ferguson Police Department in refusing to release the name of the officer, in refusing to release information early on, created the tensions that roiled that community. So transparency is key. But the key here, John, and one of the issues with that recommendation is it's a mouthful, is the issue of accountability, which, you know, one could describe as a witch hunt, except a witch hunt is when you go after something that doesn't exist. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about accountability. We're talking about unarmed African Americans being killed and no one being held responsible. That's the source of the statement, Black Lives Matter. If Black Lives Matter, then when someone takes a life wrongfully, there will be some accountability for it. And we haven't seen it.
And that leads to the fourth recommendation, which is about this internal legitimacy, create procedural justice principles within law enforcement so that the wheels turn and people can see how the wheels turn when a case like this happens. And we're seeing that in Los Angeles to a certain extent in that the death has triggered an investigation. And there is definitely a public kind of awareness that this investigation is going on. I want to conclude by getting to this last recommendation that I mentioned. Promote public trust by initiating what are called positive non-enforcement activities. I suspect that's something more than ice cream socials.
Well, I think many people can recall a time when there were police athletic leagues and when police played a role in the community as part of the community. You hear a lot of conversation about community policing. In order to do community policing, police officers have to be and experience themselves and be perceived as part of the community. Now, you know, I don't like it when people get too gauzy about the past, right? There was a time of police athletic leagues. That's very important. But even in those times, we had many of these incidents. This is not a new problem between African-American communities and the police. So that element is critically important, but it only works if all of the other elements are in place.
How engaged is the president on this? You've had some face-to-face contact with the president on this issue even recently.
I have. I've been in several conversations with the president about this, and I would have to say that he is about as committed as I could imagine a president being. I think right now, this is where the rubber meets the road. The task force that he created has laid out these recommendations, and now we're all waiting to see what the president and the administration will make of these recommendations and what they will decide to do with the power that they have to see that these recommendations come to fruition.
Sherrilyn Ifill, President and Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Sherrilyn, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
One of those recommendations yesterday from the Justice Department task force we referred to a moment ago is acknowledge the role of policing in past and present injustice and discrimination and how it is a hurdle to the promotion of community trust. To that end, in the case of Ferguson, Missouri, the federal government is conducting its own investigation into the incident where an unarmed African-American teenager, Michael Brown, was shot and killed last August by a white police officer, Darren Wilson. In the city of Portland, Oregon, a separate DOJ investigation found that Portland police routinely use excessive force against citizens with mental illness or those perceived to have mental illness. City officials settled with the Department of Justice last summer, and part of the settlement required outside monitoring of the Portland Police Department to achieve law enforcement goal number 3, establish a culture of transparency and accountability in order to build public trust and legitimacy. Dennis Rosenbaum is professor and director of the Center for Research in Law and Justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's currently working with the Portland Police Department after that Department of Justice inquiry. Welcome, Dennis.
Thank you for having me.
So do you think this outside monitoring actually establishes this culture of transparency and accountability that the federal government is talking about? And I gather you applied for the job to oversee the Portland Police Department.
Yes, we are doing that right now. And I do think it makes a difference. There have been more than 20 of these nationwide, but it's not just the outside monitor. Really, the uniqueness of places like Portland is that they have a community-wide advisory group that is involved in the oversight, involved in the reforms. And the police department's working closely and the outside monitor's working closely with them. And they have enormous input. So I think that's part of the long-term goal here with these departments.
Now, culture of transparency in the DOJ recommendation, that seems like it would involve a lot of citizens outside of just experts and community activists, that people really have to have an on-the-street sense that things have changed. Do you feel that?
No, absolutely. And, you know, the community is been harmed over the years in different cities. When you said reconcile, up until the 1960s and 70s, the police have been on the wrong side of history from the slave patrols on with regard to African-American communities. And so that's been unfortunate. And there's been enormous reform since then, but there's still a long ways to go.
And based on your experience in Portland, what have you seen the Portland PD do that you would have never expected them to do in the past? And where might you see Portland citizens involved with the police in a way that you would never have seen, a decade ago?
Well, the police are engaging in an extensive series of reforms involving changing their policies about use of force and how you interact with persons having a mental health crisis and their training programs. And so just an enormous number of things. And the new chief is committed to community-oriented approaches, engaging the community on a regular basis. So we're hoping those reforms are taken seriously. We're at the very beginning of that process. So there's a lot of compliance that needs to occur. It's on paper at this point.
Have you talked to some skeptics in your process of getting involved in this oversight?
Well, there's always going to be skeptics. Of course, some feel the reforms never go far enough and that police need a radical change in the way they do things. And so that's a concern, but we need to bring those folks into the dialogue as well. We like people who roll up their sleeves and want to work hard to see constructive changes. And I think a big part of it is training and the way that police interact with the community. They have a tough job and they encounter difficult situations, have to use their discretion, their judgment. Sometimes they have to be the tough guy. A lot more times we're hoping that they are more sensitive and compassionate and are able to take on this role of not always having to control every situation.
Finally, Dennis, anybody say to you out there in Portland, hey, professor, take care of your serious gun violence situation in the city of Chicago. Leave us alone out here. You have a lot of nerve.
The fact that we're from Chicago makes some people think we don't understand the local problems. However, I grew up in the Portland area and I'm from there. And we stay in touch every week and every day. Some of the most progressive community policing programs have been developed in Chicago. And we have a different perspective we bring that we hopefully can bring best practices and cutting edge innovation to Portland as well.
Well, best of luck to you, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Dennis Rosenbaum is Professor and Director of the Center for Research in Law and Justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's currently working with the Portland Police Department. If the spring packages to Florida and the Bahamas are all sold out, the Takeaway has found an out-of-the-way, tourist-free spot that's quite literally a once-in-a-lifetime adventure. Exoplanet 314.02. Just a few light years away, you'll never want to come home. You can't.
Here on Kepler Object of Interest 314.02, you're a long way from Earth. Over 200 light years. Love sunshine? One hemisphere of the planet always faces its star. But if you're in the mood for serious moonlight, the other hemisphere is always after dark. Like base jumping or hang gliding? KOI 314.02's low gravity allows some spectacular heights. KOI 314.02 is yours. Tickets available in 300 years, plus or minus one century.
The dream of living on another world is as old as civilization. But for the first time, humans have a destination outside of the solar system, actually a few million or more, what are called exoplanets. Scientists are actually starting to concretely calculate what it would take to visit planetary bodies discovered by the Kepler telescope in just the last few years. This week at The Takeaway, we are hearing that science directly from the Earth-based explorers at NASA. If you listen to Dr. Sarah Ballard, the NASA Carl Sagan Fellow at the University of Washington, talk about Kepler Object of Interest 314.02, that's KOI 314.02, you might think she's actually been there.
This is a system with two planets. When you start approaching the star in your starship, right away you would see that the star is very different from the sun. It looks much smaller to your eye and much redder. Your destination is O2, the second planet. You see when you come closer to it, you can't really see the surface of the planet. This is a very small planet, and yet it has a really, really thick atmosphere. So as you're diving down through the atmosphere, you look up, hoping to catch glimpses of that red host star. You start going down and down into the atmosphere, and pretty soon you lose sight of the star altogether, which isn't to say that it's dark. The star's light is still permeating through the atmosphere, but because the way that wavelengths of light are scattering, you start to see more of a red haze.
All right, so let's hold up there for just a second. As we're beginning to explore, what questions do we need to ask about the habitability that weren't answered by the exoplaneteers from their vantage point, you know, many, many light years away. And what do we have to ask as explorers? Look for this. We need oxygen, obviously, but what are the more subtle questions?
What I would want to know is the atmospheric composition. You know, I would want someone to bring back a sample of the air. That's not only for knowledge of whether I could breathe the air today. It's the O3, it's the ozone in our own atmosphere that prevents a lot of really damaging ultraviolet radiation from hitting the surface. An ultraviolet particle of light could be strong enough in some cases to just break apart a single DNA. Coming in on that low-mass star, if I were an astronomer looking out the window, realizing that I was about to land on a planet around one of the smallest type of stars, I would remember that those kind of stars are active for billions of years, you know, evolutionary timescales. By active, I mean throwing off flares of unimaginable power. I mean, we don't imagine them today. The type of flares our sun puts off that disable geosynchronous satellites or something like that, they're nothing compared to flares from this star. I would be curious, you know, will the atmosphere shield me? And especially for life on this planet, how did, under that red haze, was photosynthesis ever able to evolve? Have creatures on this planet managed to find a way to convert light into energy in a way that plants on the Earth require, you know, a full spectrum of light, much more light from the rainbow? These hypothetical plants and animals are only getting very red light. And so I would, you know, of course, the first thing I would do if I landed there was to look around to see if I saw a bug.
Of course.
if I saw a bug, I would be so excited. And then of course, I would wonder about its relative size. You know, I would be curious about the evolution of life under different gravitational circumstances. This planet is not dense like the Earth. So one of the things that I think would be first impressed upon you as the staircase of the spacecraft unfolded toward the solid ground,
right,
is the mountains loom impossibly large. The reason why mountain ranges on the Earth, they're never allowed to get too high. The gravity of the Earth pulls them back down. You can't have any one structure on planet Earth which exceeds the gravitational tug of our planet. On this planet, the gravity is so much less, you can feel it in your own body. And without that strain, that like strong resisting gravity, they've stayed very, very high. And creatures could probably evolve to be larger. And plants could evolve to be larger. You know, I would wonder whether there was something that nature selects for there.
Would you want to live in a place like this, or do you just want to be able to see it?
I would never want to live on a planet like this. That would be tough. I think of this particular planet more as a vacation planet than anything, and like an extreme vacation planet. You know how some people go on like extreme like mountain climbing excursions and like extreme parasailing. That's what this planet has to offer. You know, you could climb mountains that are much higher than anything you could climb on the Earth. You know, it would be views like from a plane, how high you would be on that mountain.
So I did KOI314.02 is the t-shirt.
That's right. Yeah, right. I parasailed KOI314.02. Right. And all I got was a stupid t-shirt.
Sarah Ballard is a NASA Carl Sagan Fellow at the University of Washington. So would you travel to another planet if it meant you couldn't come back? One listener writes from Fort Washington, Pennsylvania, I'd love to travel into space with or without returning, so long as whatever contributions I was able to make were meaningful in our discovery of alien planets. Or Philip Martin, a reporter at our partner WGBH, tweets, if I can survive Boston winters, why not Kepler-438b? Little Rock, Arkansas. No, I like my life, family, friends, and cats.
Hi, this is Philomena from Westchester. The idea of space travel absolutely fascinates me, and I love the experience, but I positively would not even consider it if there was no chance of my returning. My family is just too special to me. The thought of missing birthdays, weddings, and even funerals is just too sad of a thought to consider permanently departing from this planet.
This is Sumner from Quincy, Massachusetts. I just wanted to say that it's ridiculous that we're going to try to inhabit another planet. Earth is the best planet we have, and we really need to look into resources to help keep this planet the way it is and inhabitable.
But from Florida, oh yeah, I would bring a copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and a recipe for pan-galactic gargle blasters.
The effect of which is like having your brain smashed out by a slice of lemon wrapped around a large gold brick.
And Portland, Oregon says, no thanks. There are plenty of things to learn on this planet.
Hi, this is Karma from New York, New York. I would not travel into space on a one-way ticket, but there are a number of people I'd like to anonymously volunteer for that mission. What's the web address?
You're not the only one, Carmen, to volunteer other people for that never-return trip to an exoplanet. What's the web address? Well, you can just join the conversation at 8778-MY-TAKE. Tweet back to us at The Takeaway or just follow me at Jay Hockenberry. I'm on this planet, but considering millions of exoplanets.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. And Box Searchlight Pictures, presenting the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. The new comedy directed by John Madden, starring Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nye, Dev Patel, and Richard Gere, in theaters everywhere Friday.
A convicted rapist in India facing a death sentence told this to the BBC yesterday. A decent girl won't roam around at 9 o'clock at night. A girl is far more responsible for rape than a boy. This from a man who participated in the most notorious gang rape in Indian history. No remorse, no sign of change in the blame-the-victims mentality that has so frustrated Indian authorities trying to combat an institutionalized culture of permissiveness surrounding sexual assault. Just how institutionalized that culture is the focus of this next story. Sonia Foliero investigated a case in which a woman called here baby to her friends was allegedly gang-raped at the request of a local village council. Sonia is the author, most recently, of Beautiful Thing. Sonia's story is called 13 Men.
Baby went to the police on January 22nd, and she gave a police complaint in which she said the previous morning the council had been adjourned to judge her for the crime of having a relationship with an outsider, a Muslim man who also happened to be married and to have a couple of children. And she said that as part of that process, she was found guilty and she was asked to pay a fine. She didn't have any money on her. And she claims that the village headman then grew angry. And he said, well, if you don't have any money, we are just going to have to pay. I'm paraphrasing here in another way. And he said, he turned around and he told the men who had surrounded the young woman that they should enjoy her. And those were his words, according to Baby. A few days later, however, Baby gave her judicial testimony to the magistrate in the closest town, and she changed what she said. She then proceeded to say that she hadn't been raped on the orders of the village council. She had been raped the previous night by the headman and a group of his drunken friends. But the story that made it to the papers was the story in her police complaint, which we now know was incorrect.
What is it that the village councils in India typically enforce? What is their purpose? What are they trying to maintain when they enforce these questions of who you can marry, who you can have relations with, etc.?
You know, so many of these villages are in very remote areas. And of course, people are incredibly poor and they're very, very marginalized. And when they suffer crimes, first of all, it's very hard for them to even find a police station. On top of it all, it's very likely that if they do attempt to file a complaint, the cops will literally just laugh them out of the premises. This has happened so many times. Women have attempted to complain and they've been told to get lost, in so many words. So the fact is that many rural communities in India are forced to be self-sufficient. And over hundreds of years, they have developed methods of self-policing as a way to render justice, as a way to keep the peace. Now, certainly there can be no doubt that these village councils, some of which are based on caste, some are based on tribes, these councils have delivered imperfect justice in cases, and sometimes they have done terrible things. We have, for example, in North India, something called the Khap Panchayats, caste-based councils, that are responsible for murdering young couples who they say have married against the rules of ancient Hindu texts. So really, it depends on the council. Because these village councils are run by men, many of their decisions are patriarchal, they are misogynistic, and ultimately it's the women who suffer terribly. In this particular case as well, the 20-year-old woman baby, you know, she was judged by an all-male council. There were, at the time of the judgment, there were 70 to 80 men who had surrounded her, and she was the only woman present. Now, we don't know for a fact that this particular village council called for the rape of this young woman. But we do know that the way they went about attempting to judge her would not be acceptable in any modern society today.
When you hear stories like this, it makes it so difficult to imagine how Indian authorities would attempt to enforce laws against sexual assault when at the local level there are these kinds of prevailing patriarchal notions. How does India manage to do this, if at all?
You know, it's just really, really hard, as this case shows us. So we can talk about, for example, the things that went right with this case. You know, this young woman went to the cops. First of all, a lot of these crimes go unreported because people don't feel that the cops are going to listen to them. And they're right. But this young woman did the right thing. She went to the cops. That's the first that's a big step, really, for an Indian woman. The cops listened to her and they recorded her complaint. Again, strange though this may sound, that is not really the reaction that you would expect. They conducted the investigation very swiftly. Again, very surprising. That's something that has really changed after the December 2012 Delhi bus gang rape. Another instance of what went right is that the trial started. 31 witnesses were brought to the court. So one after the other, we see the very positive changes that have taken place. But once we came to the trial, we realized that there was the DNA and the forensic evidence that had been submitted by the cops didn't make it to the trial. It had been given to the Central Forensic Science Laboratory. The laboratory never gave back the results. And so the trial concluded without DNA evidence, forensic evidence, or in fact, conclusive medical evidence. But again, you know, this is a different part of the system that failed. And it's an example of how, for true justice to be delivered, everybody has to be able to do their jobs. And it isn't a case of people not wanting to do their jobs, at least not in this particular case. It's really about an overburdened system. It's about too many cases and too few people working. And again, if we want to deliver justice case by case, I think it's going to take more than just, you know, just changing laws or just getting the police to do their jobs. These are big things, but a lot goes into delivering justice.
Sonia Falero is a journalist and author, most recently of Beautiful Thing and co-founder of Decca, a digital publisher. She investigated the story of an alleged gang rape in West Bengal in a new story for Decca called 13 Men. Sonia, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. And ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at ShopKeep.com.
Our next guest is used to being at the center of controversy. Among Boston-based attorney Harvey Silverglade's clients are men on campus accused of sexual assault. He hears widely cited statistics like 1 in 5 women can expect to be the victim of a sexual assault during their years in college and says he's suspicious and skeptical. He's a veteran civil liberties attorney with experience going back to the anti-war cases of the 60s and 70s. But Silverglade says that universities trying to self-police cases of sexual assault on campus are out of their league. Silverglade says that colleges have skewed the system to favor spurious accusations and sexual encounters that may not be legal matters at all. He defended his belief in what he calls a hysterical overreach by colleges in an opinion piece last month published in the Boston Globe.
Well, I think we have crossed the line from serious treatment of a serious social and academic problem, that is sexual assault on campus, into the area of a social panic where irrational behavior and conduct have taken over.
Taken over in what sense?
A panic is a social phenomenon. I've lived through a couple. I've lived through the McCarthy era, which was when I was much younger. I have lived through the period when there were panic prosecutions of teachers and principals on child daycare centers concerning sexual assaults that never happened, where people start to imagine and exaggerate and go absolutely nuts. That's what's happened on the campus sexual assault arena.
Do you believe that 1 in 5 women who report sexual assault in college are imagining it?
I think that those statistics are flawed, but it actually doesn't matter from my perspective. And what I have found in the last few years is that college administrators are more interested in keeping themselves from being criticized or keeping the universities from being threatened with loss of funds than they are in doing rational fact-finding in order to find out what really happened. And so a large number of innocent men, along with the guilty men, have been thrown out of college. We cannot treat the innocent the same as the guilty. That is neither due process of law, nor is it rational, nor is it fair and decent. I actually had a case where a student was complained of because a woman said that he reminded her of somebody who had sexually assaulted her. And some campus administrator actually opened up a case to investigate this man. He reminded her. Well, when you get into that kind of territory, you know the inmates have taken over the asylum, so to speak.
You claim that date rape is a serious problem and that alcohol-fueled, ambiguous sexual encounters may result in emotional injury. And then you say that the solution is not to punish a wide range of campus behaviors that would be legally acceptable in the real world. What campus behavior involving alcohol and inappropriate sexual contact and activity would you find legally acceptable in the real world?
Well, in the real world, if two people get drunk and have sex, normally a prosecutor would not prosecute a rape charge, especially since when both parties are drunk, neither one has a very good memory of what happened. That's not the kind of stuff
prosecutions
are made.
So a woman who claims that she was raped if she was drunk, that she's actually describing a legal act?
No. When a woman is drunk and the man is drunk and neither can remember precisely what happened, what I'm saying is a responsible prosecutor would not bring a charge. And what I'm suggesting is that on campuses, the prevalence of drugs and alcohol has muddied the situation, and the efforts of college administrators should be directed at dealing with the alcohol and the drug problem. I suspect that would clear up a lot of the campus sexual assault problem.
Would you say that dealing with the drug and alcohol problem shouldn't include investigation of encounters and charges of sexual assault?
I have concluded from seeing the investigations that are done by college administrators that everybody, the whole society, the colleges themselves, and the male and female students would be better off if these cases were reported to the police or the district attorney and have truly professional, objective investigations rather than the kind of kangaroo courts that have been set up. More dangerous in a way for the man because he risks not only getting thrown out of school, but also risks criminal conviction. But I think that the society would be much better off having real criminal investigations with real consequences where a sexual assault can be proven with valid evidence.
You cite an Office of Civil Rights of the Federal Department of Education Dear Colleague letter in April of 2011, which says that colleges and universities who do not punish sexual assault would be viewed as engaging in a form of unlawful sexual harassment, and the penalty for that would have their federal funding withdrawn. But doesn't the Dear Colleague letter actually say if it goes uninvestigated, not unpunished, it's if there's no action taken against a charge of sexual assault, not that it goes unpunished?
Well, college administrators are not the most reliable people in our society. They are bureaucrats, and they are concerned primarily with making sure that their institutions do not lose federal funding. That is why in so many cases, they find that the charges are proven, even where an objective person looking at the evidence would say it's not nearly so.
Are you opposed to sexual harassment sensitivity education in the workplace, programs that have been around for years?
I am not opposed to it in the workplace, but I am opposed to it on college campuses. I think that the rules should be made clear, but I don't think that, quote, training, close quote, is appropriate for college students. Tell them the rules and tell them that they have an obligation to follow them, that if they violate them criminally, they'll be turned over to the police. And I think that's about all that intelligent college students, they're intelligent enough to go to college, they should understand that simple rule.
Well, a lot of people describe the workplace training programs as a kind of a thought retraining as well. I guess if you're a college, don't you have an interest in addressing the question of 1 in 5 women reporting sexual assault during some point of time during their college careers?
Well, I would say that turning over to the district attorney and the police, males who are accused of sexual assault, is hardly coddling them and hardly ignoring the problem. It is simply placing the problem in a sector of society that is trained and able to handle them in accordance with fairness and due process of law, something that the campus administrators have proven themselves uniquely unable to do.
Harvey Silverglade, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Harvey Silverglade is a criminal defense and civil liberties attorney and author based in Boston.
And here's something to take with you before we go. 24 years ago today, it was an unlikely coincidence that George Halliday was able to find his 2.6-pound Sony Handycam and aim it at the noisy disturbance taking place on the street beneath his balcony in L.A. What he recorded at 12:45 a.m. was Rodney G. King being beaten by police after leading them on a nearly 8-mile pursuit through the streets of Los Angeles. Those unlikely pictures, the Rodney King tape, and an even less likely jury verdict led eventually to some of the worst riots in L.A. history. Today, anyone with a smartphone carries more video capacity in a few grams than a half dozen Sony handycams, as was clear on Sunday in the Skid Row neighborhood of downtown L.A. Want to respond to anything you heard on today's program? Give us your view at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And every day you can get involved in the next day's program. Help start the conversation. Get your voice heard by texting the word START to 69866. Standard message rates apply. Thanks so much for listening on your smartphone video camera. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.